And when I get the chance, I also get to ask my colleagues, what do you think that gender medicine is about? And sometimes when I do so, they raise their eyebrows and they say, gender medicine, you want me to tell you what it is? And I have collected a number of statements over the years that I don't know if you feel reflected by them, but perhaps we can talk a little bit about it. These are the impressions of some of my coworkers. They say, the shortest one, it's rubbish, is the study of menopause. Some have said this is feminism, this is a bunch of angry nurses, they assume that all nurses are women, and also female doctors that want to have better salaries or better positions in science. They have also told me this is about women feeling forgotten, feeling mishandled, feeling discriminated, they just want more pills. Precisely like that. But then the last one, it's maybe the one I find most interesting, they told me gender medicine is a politically convenient concept that young man is not going to change anything in clinical practice. So if you have come under these impressions, I hope that today's discussion can change your way of thinking about what gender medicine should be about, because I think it's a different way of approaching disease and seeing as an opportunity the fact that we are different, that we have different bodies, different reproductive organs, different hormones, different sensitivity of these hormones into tissue, and not to say the least, we have also different number of chromosomes in each and every one of our cells. That has to count for something. And on top of these differences, we are also socially different. We have different roles in family, we have different roles in society, we have different jobs still, different expectations from what society wants from us, and also a lot of stereotypes and assumptions on how we should behave, how we should not behave, how we are meant to be. And that is also impact on how you're going to experience disease and how you are going also to interpret the information that you get from your peers. So I would think that it's only inevitable if we think in this way that two sexes may present different symptoms, different pathophysiology. They may respond differently to therapy and they tolerate or they may cope differently with the disease. And this applies to basically every disease, also chronic kidney disease. So with this definition, gender medicine is not about angry women, it's also about angry men who can benefit from a better healthcare. And when we discuss the contents of today's lecture, we thought it would be interesting if we can discuss the discussion from the other way around, from the perspective of men with chronic kidney disease. So do not be mistaken by the title. It is a pity to be a man with chronic kidney disease, but I would say that it is terrible to have chronic kidney disease regardless of the sex. And if you are not familiar with this pathology, let me just introduce it very briefly to you by telling you that it's no longer a medical specialty. Chronic kidney disease is a global health burden with a population prevalence of 10 to 14% in the latest national screening programs from many parts of the world. It's increasing in part due to the longer lifespan of the society and also to the increase in the non-communicable diseases such as diabetes, cardiovascular disease, obesity, or hypertension. And because the kidney is involved in many physiological reactions in the body, the lack of the kidney conveys many complications: diabetes, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, anemia, hyperparathyroidism, insulin resistance, cognitive disorders, dementia, Alzheimer's, osteoporosis, infections, cancer. And therefore, it may not come as a surprise that individuals with kidney disease, even mild forms of kidney dysfunction, will have a much worse survival rate. Kidney dysfunction multiplies the risk of dying in every age category, every sex, and every disease. And it means that a large proportion of patients with chronic kidney disease will die before they have the opportunity to achieve dialysis or renal transplantation. And even in the selected population of dialysis, the survival rate is very bad, with about more than 60% annual mortality rate. Similar to many metastatic cancers, by the way. So how does it look, CKD, from the perspective of men? And unfortunately, it doesn't start very good because men progress faster to end-stage renal disease than women. This means that the rate of deterioration of kidney function is much faster for men than for women. This is not a universal truth. It applies to most of CKD etiologies, but there are some distinctions. SLE, for example, and some autoimmune disorders, like some type of nephritis, would be more, would progress faster in women than in men. But for the majority of etiologies, what we see is what we have in this meta-analysis, in which all men studies show that men progress between 30 to 50% faster. The reasons of this progression are not really very well understood. Epidemiological analyses have tried to say that there are six sex differences in the way that certain risk factors are going to impact on men and women. This is analysis from the Netherlands, the PREVENT cohort, where they look into the x-axis, the impact of different risk factors for progression, age, body mass index, or glucose levels, and how they associate in men and women with the change in albuminuria over time. What it shows is that every year we grow older, the impact on progression for men will be much higher, and the same happens for every kilogram of body weight and every plasma glucose level in our blood. To me, age we cannot fix, but the other risk factors probably signify a more unhealthier lifestyle among men as compared to women, and this is something I will come back in a few of slides. Animal studies have also tried to address why men progress faster, and the easiest and best way to start is by blaming the sex hormones. So a number of studies have tried to use animal models of kidney disease, and they have either castrated the male animals or they have given high dosages of testosterone to see what happens at the level of the kidney. And some of these studies suggest that testosterone may be bad, because they have pro-apoptotic effects in the kidney cells, pro-fibrotic effects in the tubuli, and this may be the reason for the faster progression. Conversely, studies using estrogen suggest that it may be good and explain why women progress less. These studies show that estrogen may have anti-fibrotic properties, anti-apoptotic properties, and administration of estradiol, for example, in rats, improves the tubulointerstitial fibrosis. Sorry for the complicated words. In the interpretation of these findings, we often forget that reality is much more complex and that animals are not humans. And I think that it's important to reflect on this because nowadays we give much more importance to fancy knockout animal models than to real research in human beings, which at the end of the day is the ones that you have to treat. And the studies that have been performed in humans about this issue are really complicated. They are observational in nature, but if any, they suggest the opposite. These two case-controlled studies, the largest we have in the literature, published in very respectable journals, they show that not only estrogen may not be protective, but instead hormone replacement therapy associates with the incidence of microalbuminuria and also with the more rapid loss of kidney function in postmenopausal women. The issue of testosterone as progression is also complicated in view of this study published in JAMA last year, in which not testosterone administration but instead androgen deprivation was associated with the risk of acute kidney injury. This is a nested case-control study in a large population of men with metastatic, non-metastatic prostate cancer. The therapy in many cases is androgen deprivation, and those individuals that were undergoing androgen deprivation therapy or that had a history of androgen deprivation therapy in the previous 3 months, they had between 2.5 and 1.5 higher risk of acute kidney injury. It is difficult to ascertain from these pictures what is the chicken and what is the egg in the association, which one comes first. If you're interested, I can refer to you to this review that we published recently where we discussed the issue of progression in view of sex hormones in more detail. But I would say that if any, nature would give us the opposite direction because testosterone levels usually go down with reduced kidney function, and I'm gonna dedicate the last part of the talk to hypogonadism in men. And both the incidence of kidney disease and the progression to end-stage renal disease happen in the elderly age which at the same time would be the age in which our testosterone levels are at the lowest. Regardless of the cause, the fact is that because of this faster progression, probably the dialysis incidence favors men in almost every country. This is data from Sweden a couple of years ago. For every woman starting dialysis, there are two men. And in the prevalent dialysis population, also observes in all DOPS countries, there are always more men than women undergoing dialysis. I will not dwell into this because I think this deals with the talk of Henrik right after. But the fact is that these men that reach dialysis, they come to us with a much worse cardiovascular risk profile. This is a study we did in the Netherlands with all men starting dialysis at a certain year and women. And you can see that the men that start dialysis, they are younger, but they have a higher BMI. They have a more often history of cardiovascular disease, more aggressive treatment for hypertension, for drugs, lipid-lowering drugs, and also they are more usually smokers. And to me, these are also signs of more unhealthier lifestyle. And it agrees with findings for many other studies. For example, in the US, men starting dialysis are more likely to develop left ventricular hypertrophy. In Germany, men started dialysis that have higher calcification scores. In Macedonia, men started dialysis, they have more often secondary hyperparathyroidism and anadynamic bone disease, both of which, you know, are cardiovascular risk factors. And therefore, as a consequence, perhaps, men starting dialysis, they have a higher risk of cardiovascular death as compared to women. This is an analysis we did in the European Dialysis Registry, more than 100,000 patients starting dialysis from all over Europe, and you can see the relative risk of women versus men. So it means that the relative risk above one shows an increased mortality for women, a relative risk below zero, below one shows an increased mortality for men. And in this picture, you can see the death separated by cardiovascular and non-cardiovascular causes, and how men in all categories, they have approximately 20% higher risk of cardiovascular death than women. To me, all these things show that there's still a long way to go into men's health. And many of them may have to do with how men are behaving in society. And I want to share with you some statements from this EU report about the state of men's health in Europe that was published in 2012. They say that men generally identify themselves as having better health than women, but conversely, the life expectancy of men is always lower as compared to women in every country. The main cause of this early death in the men are preventable, they are due to a poor lifestyle. And among that, the social pressure that makes men to increase the likelihood of having a risky behavior. It's also an important cause of accidents. Men should be warriors, and they should have no fear and no pain. And there is a wealth of research showing that men admit to suffer less pain when the attending physician or nurse is a woman. Men have difficulty in seeking or admitting the need of help, and therefore men use health services much less often than women, and they arrive to hospital when it is too late or too advanced. Men are very difficult to engage in routine checks, which on the other hand, they are more implemented and established in women. Prostate cancer, we don't screen that often as the general mammography screenings. There is no research almost about the attitudes towards chronic kidney disease for men and for women. The only ones I have found, they tell me that men with chronic kidney disease more often rely on avoidance, that is smoking, irregular overeating, drinking, lack of compliance as a way of coping with their disease. This avoidance may explain, for example, some randomized control trials such as this one from Australia, where they tried the impact of nutritional counseling, nutritional education in maintaining nutritional status in patients with chronic kidney disease. And you can see that the trial was effective. Individuals that attended these educational sessions, they have a better lean body mass as assessed by bioimpedance. They ended up eating more, and they also ended up having a higher consumption of protein. But if you see the results, all these differences are only observed in the female population. The male man did not seem to react to any of these educational sessions. And I may want to ask you, who is the best compliant patient? Who would be the best compliant patient for you? The woman. But that's not exactly true. The best compliant patient is the married man, because then there is a woman that takes care of him. The second best compliant patient then is the woman. And that's this, and that is the stereotype that we have, many of us. But maybe it's a stereotype that we need to challenge. And I want to show you this study that was also published a few years ago about the perceived versus the real compliance of the patients. This is a study from Japan, 3,000 men undergoing dialysis, 3,000 men and women. They were asked how compliant they were with therapy. And you can measure compliance by looking at some biochemical parameter that would reflect the efficacy of therapy. In dialysis, you can say that urea nitrogen would be a way of measuring the effectiveness of the therapy. So when they ask the men, how is your compliance, those that reported to be low compliant, they did have low urea nitrogen. And those who reported to have a high compliant or who felt that they were high compliant, they have a higher urea nitrogen. When they ask to women, they observe this gray zone in their answers. And approximately 50% of the women who were compliant in reality were not, and vice versa. This doesn't mean that the women were lying. It means that the women, they believed to be more compliant than they really were. And when you dig into this issue, there is also a wealth of research showing how the women's psychology puts, even in the case of the disease, their health, the family's health, the family's preoccupation, taking care of everything, is still as a priority at the expense of her own health. So these diseased women, they especially probably in the society context of Japan, they continued to take care of everything as if nothing had happened, and they didn't have time to take care of themselves. I bring this story not so that we should be so critical as Stalin was about himself. We have to trust the patients, but we have to also to challenge the stereotypes that we have in our mind. Women are not always the best compliant. And in this context, I became interested about gender medicine, and I wanted to find if there's any difference in pathophysiology. And I found these differences in the role of endocrine abnormalities. And in normal condition, the kidney is necessary for the metabolism and synthesis and elimination of many hormones. And in our disease, we end up with many of these endocrine abnormalities. Some of them have had relatively few attention or no attention. One of them is prolactin. Prolactinemia. I will not have time to discuss the interesting potential links between prolactin levels and cardiovascular risk in patients on dialysis, but I just want to use this slide to show you that prolactin is mainly eliminated by the kidney, and therefore individuals with anuria, without kidney function, they will develop a mild prolactinemia. Not so big such as be considered a prolactinoma, but still above the reference range. And this is a unique situation. I don't think there are many diseases in which both men and women will develop hyperprolactinemia. And one of the functions of prolactinemia is to inhibit gonadotropin secretion. And therefore, this hyperprolactinemia will have different consequences in men or in women with chronic kidney disease. In women, hyperprolactinemia leads to amenorrhea, premature menopause, 5 years earlier than in non-CKD women, and infertility. In men, it leads to erectile dysfunction, loss of libido, and testosterone deficiency. Testosterone deficiency, or hypogonadism, is probably the most common endocrine disorder that men with chronic kidney disease have. irrespective of age, testosterone levels goes down with reduced kidney function. This is our own data, about 300-400 men with different stages. You can see how testosterone levels go clearly down with the CKD stages, and it means that the prevalence of hypogonadism will go progressively up. So in this age range of 60 to 70 years in which men usually come to our clinic, the prevalence of hypogonadism is about 20% in the general population. In this population with advanced and severe chronic kidney disease, it goes as high as 50%. This is not only the findings of Karolinska Institute, this seems to be happening in all parts of the world. The latest screenings on hypogonadism in Canada, Greece, Turkey, or also our own, show that between 40 to 50% of men undergoing dialysis are in the have testosterone levels in the range of hypogonadism. Now, we went through the medical chart of all these people, and we wanted to see how many of these hypogonadal patients were receiving treatment, and we found that there were less than 5% of them, which to me signifies the maybe relatively lack of importance that we have given in nephrology to this hormonal derangement. When I have asked my colleagues, they tell me, well, these men are 70 years old, they have many other problems to think about than their libido. But testosterone is an anabolic hormone with many effects on the body beyond libido and masculinity. So the causes of testosterone deficiency in chronic kidney disease is not only prolactin retention, it's also, of course, aging. Our patients are older and older every time. Our patients have comorbidities that induce further the prevalence of hypogonadism, such as cardiovascular disease, diabetes, obesity, and rheumatoid flares. And our patients consume on a daily basis medication that it's known to also reduce testosterone production. This is the case of ACE inhibitors, ARBs, statins, vitamin D, and cinacalcet. They all further reduce testosterone production. And why is this important? Because a couple of years ago, we observed that patients with hypogonadism in our unit, they tended to die faster. Now, this is a small study with about 150 patients, not very impressive, but it has had echo in the scientific community, and it has had replication in other cohorts, like, for example, in Greece, in Turkey. This is a large study from Canada. This is a large cohort from the US about patients with successful kidney transplantation, and also in extraction of men with CKD stage 3,000 or 4,000 people from Cleveland. So what is testosterone deficiency? Is it a risk factor? Because then we can intervene. Is it a reflection of comorbidities, of disease severity? Is it only an adaptation towards the sparing of energy, that is, reduce anabolism to be able to save? I'm going to make a spoiler alert, and at the end of the talk, I will not be able to answer what is a risk factor and what is a risk marker. Unfortunately, this is a debate that also goes on in the field of testosterone outside nephrology. It's difficult to ascertain, but we can try to decide together in view of the clinical implications, at least from the studies that have been done in chronic kidney disease. And the clinical implications are summarized here. Some of them I have already mentioned briefly, the mortality, the graft survival that you saw in that paper of transplantation. And I want to focus on three other aspects that may be important to explain the cardiovascular risk of these patients. The first one is that testosterone is an anabolic agent with a potent effect on muscle growth. This is not only known by us, it's known also by the athletes that want to cheat in their muscle building. The mechanisms are many. The testosterone influences the myocyte stem cell differentiation. They inhibit IGF synthesis. They induce IGF synthesis. They inhibit myostatin expression. And in the elderly individuals, those that have appropriate endogenous testosterone, they have a better preservation of lean body mass. I find interesting that in chronic kidney disease, where we have so many catabolic conditions and so many catabolic entities, starting by the uremia in itself, still testosterone levels are strongly associated with the muscle mass and muscle strength. This is a study we did with about 300 men, CKD stage 2 to 4. None of them were consuming testosterone medication, and you can see how they are a function of the muscle muscle strength as assessed by a dynamometer, and they are a function of also of fat-free mass, as I said, as assessed by bioimpedance. Similar observations have been done in hemo and dialysis patients. And the question of whether this can be a therapy for us was already answered 15 years ago in these papers from the US, in which testosterone was given to both men and women in supraphysiological dosages as a means to improve the nutritional status. These two studies show that testosterone supplementation in these men and women increase lean body mass and reduce body fat, as it happens, or as it shows in the vast majority of trials outside the renal community. If you combine this anabolic agent with exercise training, then the benefit in muscle mass growth would be better. Still, these papers were 15 years old and have had little echo in clinical practice. To me, it poses a question: if hypogonadal men are more prone to muscle wasting, sarcopenia, maybe the restoration of this deficiency would lead to improvement in some of these outcomes. Testosterone also is an anabolic hormone by inducing erythrocytosis. It mobilizes iron stores, it has a direct effect on erythropoietin synthesis, and also modifies hepcidin action. This is usually interpreted as an adverse effect of testosterone replacement therapy and appears as such in all the labels. However, it is also an opportunity for the treatment of anemia. And maybe the most senior of this room would remember that before erythropoietin was put in the market in 1992, testosterone was one of the most important strategies to treat anemia in patients with chronic kidney disease. It was given to the dialysis patients in high dosages in formulations that no longer exist. There were no major adverse effects. There was an important and interesting control of hemoglobin. Then we wonder, maybe these individuals that are common and untreated, they may have, by virtue of their hypogonadism, more risk of anemia or may require higher dosages of erythropoietin. So we did this study in two cohorts to study the probability of testosterone levels or hypogonadism to lead to anemia. We went to a cohort of 240 individuals with pre-dialysis CKD not receiving erythropoietin. And we could observe that testosterone deficient patients were 4.3 times more likely to have anemia than testosterone sufficient patients after adjustment for various confounders. To study the association between testosterone hypogonadism and the dose of erythropoietin, we went to another cohort of dialysis patients. All of them were receiving erythropoietin-stimulating agents. And those that were testosterone deficient were 2.7 times more likely to require higher dosages of erythropoietin than testosterone sufficient ones. And to me, this makes another interesting question. Would the correction of hypogonadism in chronic kidney disease contribute to reduce the burden of anemia and also to reduce the dosages of ESA? Because the dosages of ESA has a cost for the medical healthcare, which is probably 50 times higher than the cost of one testosterone injection, to say the least. Finally, testosterone also has effects on the heart and blood vessels. There are direct effects, like effects on calcium channels, on nitric oxide production, on the synthesis of endothelial progenitor cells, and there are indirect effects via immunomodulation, via effects on the metabolic syndrome, or the components of the metabolic syndrome. Alike in the general population, those with low testosterone levels undergoing dialysis, they have a state of endothelial dysfunction. These are two studies from our group showing the strong almost direct association between testosterone levels and flow-mediated dilatation before dialysis and in dialysis patients. And maybe also as a consequence, low testosterone levels increases or associates with the increase of cardiovascular events. This is the 3-year risk of cardiovascular events among a cohort of 300 men, non-dialysis stages 1 to 5. And every nanomole per liter increase would reduce the risk of, in testosterone, would reduce the risk of cardiovascular events by approximately 20%. This to me leads to the final question I want to pose to you. Would correction of hypogonadism in chronic kidney disease reduce the risk of cardiovascular events? And as I told you, I cannot answer whether it's a risk marker or a risk factor. We do not have any interventional evidence. We are working on it and we can discuss it further about what would happen if we simply correct hypogonadism. However, if it is a risk marker, I would say that a screening for testosterone would be important for risk stratification and decisions on medical therapy. If it is a risk factor, then we can restore it. And there are means to do that, and endocrinologists do it on a regular basis. If you are interested on the topic, then I can refer to these reviews that we did a couple of years ago where we discuss in much more detail all these areas, and I would be happy to provide if you just write me an email. Caution is recommended, and we can also discuss safety, but we are not proposing to give testosterone to all our patients. We are simply proposing to restore those levels that are deficient, and I think that that is the basis of medical practice, to restore deficiencies to normality. Until we have interventional evidence, I think that it's enough if we are aware of the problem, if we screen, and if we find suspicion for deficiency, we refer the patient to the endocrinologist who would decide the best course of action. I would call for caution about the uncontrolled over-the-counter use of testosterone supplements. I don't know if this is available in your country. In the US, it's growing every day. And I wouldn't recommend use of these medications if there is no suspicion of deficiency. And this is all I wanted to say. I don't know if I am on time. I hope I am on time. Listening to scientific presentations is hard. I hope you do not feel like these people here. Maybe you have felt. I will not take it personally. Perhaps it's because it's late and you have been working all day. However, if I have made you feel like this, I'm sorry. There is still one opportunity more to find out what I was talking about. If someone would ask you tomorrow, what did he say? We can maybe summarize it in one slide and two very simple messages. We have been talking about gender medicine in men, and I have been showing you some of our own examples where we think that gender-based approaches to kidney disease, they can be an opportunity to improve patient care. We identify areas where men and women differ, and we have shown you that men do worse. They progress faster to end-stage renal disease. They have a higher cardiovascular risk. They adopt avoidance as an attitude towards their disease. And I have also shown you that chronic kidney disease may lead to different pathophysiological mechanisms in men and in women by virtue of these endocrine disorders. Of the endocrine disorders, I focus on testosterone, and I told you that this is probably one of the most common deficiencies of chronic kidney disease. It has received very little attention, but it's not, testosterone deficiency is not only about libido and sexual function, it participates in other pathways that may lead to increased cardiovascular risk. We have discussed muscle catabolism, we have discussed anemia, and we have discussed atherosclerosis. And I propose, and I hope to be able to demonstrate it in the trials we are conducting, that it is possible that restoration of this endocrine deficiency may translate into improved cardiovascular outcomes for this population segment, which at least represents 60% of all the dialysis patients that you have in your unit. Thank you very much.